Mini episode 170 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by that NBA lottery pick, your pop culture influenced look at the world of hoops. Follow them on the web at that NBALotteryPick.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Okay, folks, it is mini episode 170. Rick Morris, Kyle Ross bring you the Kyle Ross History of SummerSlam Anthology. This is part 3C. We're calling an audible here and breaking off 2002 on its own. The one that you,
this
Kyle,
isn't in my script.
Yeah.
You have, Tony.
You have deemed this the greatest SummerSlam of all time.
Yes.
Here's what's very interesting. I look at this. We did 98 and 99 as one. We were initially going to do 2000, 2001, 2002 as one, but I'm glad that we were able to give 2000 and 2001 the time that they deserved. So that's why we're breaking them off
basically,
separately.
Well, we just started babbling so it much was that we had to. Let's be honest here.
I prefer my spin job on that to yours. Yes. But here's what I noticed. 2000, 2001, 2002, the one commonality that they have, and this was after Austin, Rock, and Triple H had been elevated as, you know, three megastars in the company. These last three SummerSlams comprising this era, you only had two of the three at any given point in time that were on the show. In 2000, Steve Austin was on the shelf still with the neck injury.
Yes.
In 2001, Triple H had the quad injury. And in 2002, Steve Austin had walked out of the company due to bad booking and various issues months before.
Yeah, so Austin was out of the picture for two of these. Yeah.
Two of these, and Triple H was out of it in 01. And yet, they continued to do strong business. Now, as you'd said off air, and I agree with you, 2002... the first post-boom SummerSlam, and yet it was one that did, you know, I recall, pretty good business overall. It was first one in the brand split era, but it had a lot of star power that the previous SummerSlam did not have, and that's what accounts for this. This is one of those ones, and it's sort of precursors a little bit. Like, I remember, like, SummerSlam 06 when you were doing the Sunday Night Submission show. That wasn't a great SummerSlam, but there was a lot of star power of, like, Hogan and Flair and Sabu and all these freaking guys. 02 kind of reminds me of that in a little bit of a way.
It's funny, and we'll just a little tease for when we kill the rest of the SummerSlams all in one podcast. Mm-hmm. 03, 06, I think, is actually wound up. I was doing my homework for these things. Mm-hmm. 06 is a pretty good SummerSlam.
It's a funky, eclectic one as far, like, you could have, like, a fun trivia game in a bar some night about what pay-per-view had this guy
exactly
on it. You would never believe it.
But this one, you're right, had some star power. And let's again set this up.
Yep.
So the invasion angle flopped miserably.
Yep.
It was killed off. And then 2002 just got wacky, man. I mean, it got wacky, didn't it?
Yeah.
There was a lot of head-scratching things, and they did the brand. Well, first of all, WWE now. It's no longer WWF.
Get the F out.
Yeah,
yep.
You're telling me. Yeah, get the F out.
That's what the fans did, actually.
Yes, yeah, yes. And they do the brand split. And like the invasion, they really didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah.
Because
that was a commonality point.
Okay, they didn't know what the hell they were doing. Because if you look at the way they have the brand split here to the way they would do it in subsequent years, and the way that it's basically been completely eviscerated today,
mm-hmm.
it's just different. At this point, you had one world champion still.
Yep.
You had the world champion on both shows. If you were the world champion, you were the only guy who could be on both shows.
This was the end of that brief era.
Yes, this was the end. Yeah, but shortly after this, they changed it.
Yep.
Again, because Triple H. Yeah. If you have Triple H.
Got to get him a big gold belt.
But so you had one champion, and you had the Intercontinental Champ was property of one. The U.S. was the property of the other. You had Bischoff and Stephanie in charge of the two brands.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a big deal, the whole Raw versus. They were trying to get it over. I've never liked the brand extension.
Mm-hmm.
I know why they did it, but to me it's lazy booking. It's the only thing I've ever agreed with Buck Woodward on, I swear to God. That he was like, to me, it's just like an excuse, okay, well, we're just making it easy on ourselves. This guy's got to be on this show. This guy's got to be on that show. And I completely agree with them because their whole thing is, well, we used to have two touring groups. Well, to the average wrestling fan, that doesn't mean squat.
Yeah.
It's like if I told a lot of my buddies who watched wrestling in the 80s but don't read wrestling on the internet and don't really care to, oh, you know that they used to run like three different touring house show groups in the 1980s. They'd be like, oh, that's kind of interesting, I guess. Like, that's not something
just,
that...
You just assign guys to the different shows based on
now, I
the
know,
need of each card.
Now, I know there's logistical things with planes, and then you're going to have guys missing flights and whatever.
Well, they generally did it, did they not? Where, I mean, A shows, B shows, C shows, it would be a thing where... So you just do it where it's a loop of, okay, these are the guys who are going to be in the biggest cities.
Yeah.
These are going to be the guys in the cities that are going to step down, and these are guys who are going to be in the small towns if they're going to do that. But, I mean... It's not the hardest thing in the world to plan.
No, it wasn't.
And
no, it was
my thought at the time, when I first found out about this, yeah, I read it in
I
the
was
sheets.
So against it.
And I was like, wait a minute. Okay. So this is like, this is why I'm not telling you, wait a minute. I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute. I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, Ricky. So it's going to be like WWF A and WWF B. And it was like... The notion that it was going to be under Raw and SmackDown brands, I thought was just the goofiest thing in the world. And when I was explaining that to some of my friends, they couldn't believe it.
Well, here's the thing. They did have, at the time when this was conceived, the star power to pull this off, which is certainly not the case today.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, when you look at their roster, 2002 compared to 2012,
yeah,
it's almost night and day.
Yeah.
But you mentioned Austin walking out because bad booking. That killed the thing. I think that killed it dead right away because the whole thing is you had Austin and Rock now in 2002, both as baby faces.
Yeah.
Firmly established baby faces that had been baby faces for years. They were, you know, neither of them were at their hottest point. I would argue Rock was hotter in 2002. But so you can get them, you can have, the thought probably was, I'm just guessing, okay, we can have Austin carry one brand, Rock carry the other. Well, Austin, you know, almost immediately quit, and that screwed a lot up.
And they did know Rock was going to be out doing movies, too, so he wasn't going to be the full-time guy.
Yeah, that's very true. But they did have a lot of talent. They did the draft and whatever, but I didn't like it at the time, selfishly, because I couldn't get SmackDown in Athens.
Okay.
And I remember I was like, I've always said, this has been one of my, and this is coming from me, is one of the most bizarre criticisms you could ever expect. I believe, this is why I think the brand extensions never worked to the capability they thought it could. That 4 hours, that expecting your fan base, a large portion of your fan base, to watch 4 hours of first-run wrestling per week is too much.
That's true. That's a very good point.
I don't even like to do it. Now, do I watch, has there been large portions of my life where I've watched more than 4 hours of wrestling in a week? Of course there is.
Right.
But I'm not the person you need to worry about hooking in.
No, it's true.
And I didn't. And the thing is, when I watch it, it's old stuff where it's not. You don't really have to concentrate or remember.
Sure.
So I didn't like it from that perspective that they were kind of requiring you to watch 4 hours of first run wrestling. Now, it made for some interesting stuff. I mean, SmackDown got really good, and by the end of two after this show, particularly.
Right.
But the one thing that this whole era did bring that was good was the ascension of Brock Lesnar, who's
sure.
obviously, you know, everyone knows now, you know, he's back, he's come
yep.
full circle, and he, you know, had a tremendous stint in the UFC as their heavyweight champion.
He was pushed to the moon from day one here, an unprecedented push for a young guy.
And, well, all based on money, because what they paid him. And
really? Because he'd been in developmental for a long time, doing the whole Minnesota stretching crew.
Not
thing
a long
with,
time.
Sheldon
Trust
Benjamin.
Me, Jim Cornette wanted to keep him. Trust me. There was.
I thought it went back to 2000.
There was a big, big, well, I mean, when you think about it, I mean, nowadays, the way they rush guys up doesn't seem like, at the time, man.
I mean,
you're talking
a year a long time. Now, maybe I'm wrong about it being as long as a year.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong about that.
But I remember Cornette saying, no, 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 don't bring him up yet. And them saying, we're paying him all this money. He's coming
okay.
up.
Okay.
But here's the thing. Like we talked about at the beginning of part three of this anthology, how well-promoted Austin Undertaker is arguably as well-promoted as any SummerSlam main event they've ever done. I would say this one was better. Rock versus Brock Lesnar. You had the established guy, Rock. Austin's mm-hmm. out of the picture. And Rock was very... He'd come back, essentially. He'd taken some time off after WrestleMania to do a movie and then became basically a part-time performer from there on out.
They did the OMG Pure Sports build for this.
and it was great.
Mm-hmm.
It was great. And Rock had come back the previous month and won the title, basically so he could be the champion and job to Lesnar to make it a bigger deal. Because
mm-hmm.
if you remember, they had really done a hot potato with the title after WrestleMania. You had Triple H.
Oh, yeah.
Triple H, Hogan, weaseled his way into a title run.
WCW 99 thought that their title picture was convoluted.
And then Undertaker had that awful run as a heel world champion that came to an end with Rock.
It's my yard.
Yeah, that was bad. Yeah, no one bought him. Again, logistically, no one bought, like Austin, no one wanted to boo Undertaker during this period.
Or call him Booger Red, aside from JR.
Yes. But, so you had this, you had a wonderful main event, Rock versus, it's kind of weird to say Rock Lesnar. You know, you know what I'm saying? Because it's Brock Lesnar. But you had Rock versus Lesnar, a perfect main event for the show. It's not the greatest match of all time. Everyone knew. I mean, everyone. I don't even think, you know, there was a single, even maybe the little kids didn't, but everyone knew Lesnar was going over here.
And that Long Island crowd really turned on Rock, setting the stage for the heel turn the next year.
Yeah, because, there had been a lot of instances. Remember, they had booed him against Hogan, they booed him against Rock. Two WrestleManias in a row, he went as a babyface and got booed against a heel.
Yeah.
But, whatever. I think that had a lot to do with the fact that Lesnar had been booked so well and everyone knew he was getting the title.
Yep.
It was a different crowd by 2002.
Yep. So you had that going on. That was the main event for the Undisputed title, which was about to become very disputed.
Yes.
the guy disputing it largely actually lost in a clean finish in a street fight here. Triple H losing to Shawn Michaels. They did the whole thing. Triple H's face run was so miserably booked during this period of time that by the time the summer came around, it was almost inevitable they were going to turn him heel again. He did so on Shawn Michaels in a kind of convoluted storyline where he turned on him twice.
Yeah, that was bad. But the main thing was, and I'm a big Michaels mark,
mm-hmm.
obviously, and I was always – it got to the point where it's like, man, I guess he's never going to – he hadn't wrestled since 98. And I remember Jerry Lawler. I watched the show live, and I was really excited for it. And Jerry Lawler makes this comment. He's like, do you realize, JR, there's some people out here who may have never even seen Shawn Michaels wrestle? And I remember feeling so old when he said that. That was like the first time I felt old as a wrestling fan. I was like, oh, my God. Because I've been waiting so long. It'd been almost 4.5 years. This, to me, I don't know if you're going to find a bigger fan of this match than me.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe someone's because I'm such a Michaels mark, but it was so perfectly played with some vintage JR commentary here. Triple H was brilliant beating up on Michaels' injured back. It's so funny that
Michaels even do the kip up at one point?
At the end, it was so awesome. I literally jumped out of my chair watching that live. I was like, oh my God. Because JR just lost it, and the crowd lost it, too. Because you didn't think he was going to. You kind of forgot about that whole thing.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't until this run. It's ironic that Michaels is so fondly remembered as the best worker of that down period.
Mm-hmm.
I could argue that when he came back, it was a much better. Like, he was a much better babyface in his second incarnation than he ever was when he was the world champion in 96.
Well, they weren't pigeonholing him with the Chippendales.
Exactly, because he was old.
There's something to be said for being older, because then they can't be like, oh, he's so irresistible to the girlies that we're going to package him as something that the guys hate. When you have a little bit more of that maturity in your face and they're not tempted to do that, then it works better.
He was great. He was much better as kind of the old veteran, kind of the old, you know, the cowboy on a steel horse he rides. You know what I'm saying?
Did we ever get an explanation? Because that whole period of time he was out, the kind of surgery he had, it was firm that you cannot ever, you'll be in a wheelchair if you try to come back if you have this kind of, and then he came back and had a great part two of his career for 8 years after that. Did we ever find out what the deal was?
He also had a lot of drug problems when he's gone.
Well, I know he had a lot of drug problems. Okay, so I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb and assume that the back surgery
was kind of exaggerated. I think
had to have been.
They wanted him to come back a year and a half earlier.
Yeah, and he almost did about the time of the invasion, but that he showed up pilled in Cleveland the night of the WCW.
Takeover. This is a wonderful match. I give it 4.75 stars. It's
okay,
top five SummerSlam match.
Okay,
and it's funny because he didn't wrestle again for 3 months after this, if you remember, because Triple H injured him after the match again.
Well, they kind of build it as a one shot, anyways.
That's what I was gonna say. Who would have ever thought that after watching this match, Shawn Michaels would proceed to wrestle for like 8 more years?
Yeah. And as awesome as he was before he left, have a part two of his career that a lot of people would say stacks up pretty well next to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing that that happened. But great work rate up and down this card, star power, a match that had both. It was actually the opener. That's how stacked this card was. Kurt Angle and Rey Mysterio, the pay-per-view debut in the WWF, now WWE, I guess, as Rey Mysterio. And coming in with the mask and the whole garb and everything like that. And they did the whole kind of funny storyline with him and Kurt Angle. And I'm gonna treat you just like I treat like a little kid. I love to treat little kids a certain way. Like Kurt Angle with his goofy kind of.
Yeah, he was like petting him on the head. This is a great opener. This is one of the. You talk about opener. This is, I would be willing to wager, the best opener in SummerSlam. This is a really good match. This is real good. Now, Ray Jobs.
Which is a little curious, but Angle was a debut. Top guy. You know,
Ray was the one guy, you talk about some logistical nightmares, the invasion, mm-hmm. that it wasn't like when he debuted, it wasn't like, oh man, I wish he could have come in and been a part of an invasion angle. Because mm-hmm. he's such a standard, like, I remember when they tried to turn him heel in WCW without the mask, that was so stupid.
Yeah, the whole thing with the filthy animals.
This was a great, great match. I mean, I could argue that, kind of Ray should have won, but this is a wonderful opener, and he kind of got over it because, you know, he kind of found his niche in the SmackDown 6 as a partner with Edge. You know, certainly Ray was a big star pretty quickly, I think, into it. I mean, they didn't think he was like a world champion as he would become later, and
right.
Some would argue that he never should have been, but he got over real quick, and I like that match a lot.
He did. You talk about that, and as far as the filthy animals go, one of the great unresolved angles of all time, burying Ric Flair in the desert in Nevada in the fall of 1999. Ric Flair had long since reemerged by 2002. How's that for a segue?
Yes.
And defeated Chris Jericho. How far down the card had Jericho fallen from being undisputed champion going into WrestleMania to jobbing to Ric Flair here? Again, not even a Ric Flair that was being set up for big things on the babyface side, for a Ric Flair that was getting set up to turn heel because he was unsatisfied with his lot in life. Yes. This made no sense.
I don't know if Jericho, if they were kind of punishing him for maybe not carrying the belt they wanted during his reign.
I think that's it. Yeah.
But he was, I mean, God, he was booked so badly in 02. It wasn't until he kind of, like, they had just beaten the life out of all of his fans and realized, okay, well, he's not going to be a top guy, that he didn't kind of, like, reestablish himself when he started doing stuff with Christian.
Yeah.
You know, that he got, like, I was like, okay, Jericho's good. Because he was just, like, they did something. Didn't Ric Flair interrupt the Fozzy concert? I remember that was kind of interesting.
I think so, yeah.
That was good. But,
well, yeah, like, that.
Want to know something that's shocking? Want to know how low they had Jericho on the card? Do you even remember this? Do you remember how this match ends?
Oh, yeah, by submission, figure four. Nobody submitted to the figure four.
The last guy who submitted to the figure four, I think, was Randy Savage in, like, 92 when Razor Ramon debuted, for God's sake.
Oh, okay. I was going to go further back. I thought George South on World Championship
yeah,
Wrestling.
Yeah, I know. You know what I'm saying? It's like, God. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if this was, like, one of those things that they wanted to establish, but you're right. They didn't have big plans for Flair as a babyface.
Yeah,
It made no sense. But it was. But, again, almost every match on this show was good, and that was a good match. Questionable booking aside,
you talk about excellent match, excellent workers. How about Edge and the returning Eddie Guerrero?
They had better matches than this. Actually, every match they had got better. I remember Unforgiven 02, which has some real good matches on it, marred by a stupid finish in Brock Lesnar Undertaker.
Okay,
not their Hell in a Cell match. They had a regular match that ended in a non-finish at that particular show. And then they had the great one, Edge and Guerrero, on SmackDown. Some people feel that's the best match in SmackDown history, the street fight.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, these guys were – this was a great mid-card feud. Again,
yeah.
Thumbs up for that.
Yeah, really, really good. Again, it's some really good workers in this next one here, tag team title match. Storm and Christian against the team that I told you I think is one of the great overlooked tag teams of this period, Book Dust.
I love that match.
Yeah.
Did they –
Storm and Christian won the belts as they were doing the Un-Americans run here, which is the same thing that Test was a part of when he did his match against The Undertaker.
Which is the one.
The Undertaker face, you know, just like playing up like in 1993 when he stood up to Yokozuna with the American flag.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the Un-Americans was kind of a terrible idea. You probably liked it.
It led up. Well, no, I didn't like it because they were teasing a flag burning at MSG on like the 1 year anniversary of 9/11. So that's what they were having to resort to getting heat at that point.
That was terrible. Why would you do something like that?
It was horrible. It was absolutely tasteless.
Remember they made them all cut their hair too?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah,
they did.
So, but I can't remember. Booker T and Goldust, they didn't have the belts, did they, at this point?
I think they did, and I think they dropped them to Storm and Christian here.
I thought they, like, lost. I thought they hadn't won them yet.
Oh, maybe they hadn't.
What's so funny is how I can recall, like, that because it was so much more simplistic, but the title pictures in, like, 88, 89 compared to, like, 10 years ago.
This was, like, their version of doing the Evil Canadians, like, in 97. But with calling them the Un-Americans, they were clearly going for the post-9/11.
Yeah, and they did a bunch. They La Resistance with the French.
Subsequently, yeah.
I mean, it was an okay match. I remember that heat with really Booker T was getting really over. Booker T and Goldust worked as a great team.
They were.
Because
they were so good together.
Because Goldust could always play Ricky Morton.
Yep.
And Booker T got really over by always getting the hot tag.
Yep. So Booker T, in that sense, was Barry Windham 2K2.
Yes.
10 years later. And then another one here, I mean, in terms of work rate, I would have said once upon a time, two of my all-time favorite workers. I can't classify the one guy in the same sense anymore. Rob Van Dam over Chris Benoit for the Intercontinental title.
Yeah, this was a fun little thing. The Intercontinental title was kind of changing hands a little too much for my taste, I remember, during this period. But RVD was really over during here. In fact, he was so over, if you recall, that he would challenge Triple H in a main event the following month in a program where that was seemingly created to firmly just make RVD crack, show that RVD wasn't a main eventer.
Sure.
Even though I thought that run had money written all over. I thought RVD was a much better choice than Booker T during that time period to chase Triple H.
Sure.
And, I mean, didn't matter.
He got the one pay-per-view out of it, the one where Ric Flair turned on him and started the seeds of evolution.
Yeah, and it was funny. It's kind of irrelevant because neither guy got over on Triple H anyway. But I thought most people kind of thought Booker T was a better long-term answer. I thought RVD was, personally, but that's just me.
It's funny because you go back to SummerSlam 99 about how backstage politics kind of seep through on air. You know, the Undertaker is going to show the Big Show how we do things here. Nothing is ever going to be better than Ric Flair and Triple H teaming together to beat Rob Van Dam in an exact parallel of what was going on behind the scenes.
Yes.
Sometimes the morality play plays out. We rarely in any of these things have talked about all the matches on the show, although we've talked about all of them here. I'm even going to bring up, which I haven't done on all the other ones necessarily, from the pre-show, from Sunday Night Heat, just because, again, indicative, such an excellent show in terms of workers. I don't have any remembrance of this match, but it had the potential to be a really good one. Spike Dudley and Stevie Richards on the pre-show. I mean, you know, two guys like that could have
been two underrated guys. Spike Dudley had that great, you know, they really hosted. Remember that night when Austin was a heel?
Yeah.
And they did the petition angle, and Spike Dudley ripped it up, and then they just buried him with Austin. Spike Dudley had something. Both of those.
One of the greatest talents of all time at garnering sympathy. What an amazing sympathy magnet.
Yeah. I'll be honest with you. Mm-hmm. Spike Dudley, all things considered, did not have a bad WWF run.
No. And Stevie Richards, one of the. And again, I'm not going to exaggerate and say that, like, he could have had Triple H's career, but one of the guys that I really liked that I thought there was, like, a lot more that could have been done with him over the course of his career.
A lot of people thought.
I was a big BWO mark.
Yeah, I'll never forget the EC, when an ECW invaded Raw in 97.
Okay.
And they did the BWO shtick. Uh-huh. I'll never forget. Stevie Richards legitimately, and maybe this is how he parlayed into getting a job with WWF later. He cracked when he did the, we got three words for you, we're taking over. Vince McMahon very legitimately cracked up at that. Because, and I'll never forget Jerry Lawler going, oh, here we go, another ECW ripoff. And Heyman daring him, but going, oh, what are we ripping off here? and Lawler couldn't say it. Lawler didn't dare say it. Hate Paul Heyman on that show behaved like such an ass that it was so glorious.
Which is why I love Heyman.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
But yeah, Spike and Richards, that just struck me.
A lot of people thought the right to censor because they saw Stevie Richards as not a main event level guy.
Uh-huh.
That when Austin came, like, to me, instead of him battling Rikishi. Now, granted, yeah, they have that dumb storyline about him being run over in a car, mm-hmm. which was dumb because it was such false promotion that they waited till the night of the show to take him out of the main event.
Yeah, Austin. That was bogus.
They should have never done that. If you're going to have Austin kind of come back and do something and just mm-hmm. need to get some heat, they just, yeah, Stone Cold, you know, get those people fired up.
Yeah.
Why not have him, like, a lot of people thought that Vince McMahon and the RTC could have teamed up to oppose Austin for a nice little fall program.
Yeah, but it's, you know.
In their mind, you know, Stevie Richards.
The height fetish.
Stevie Richards was not worthy of being in a high caliber match with Steve Austin. I wonder how Steve Austin would have felt about that. Because I watched his DVD recently
mm-hmm.
and agreed with everything he said. So to me, Steve Austin, maybe, I don't know, former ECW guy, maybe he gives him a little. I mean, I'm not saying that Austin should have put him over, but I think Austin would have enjoyed working with him.
Here's the irony. So the Steve Austin character, beer swilling, foul mouth, etc., really behind the scenes, Steve Austin could be a little bit, once he garnered power, of a Chardonnay-sipping elitist. Because if you remember, like, in 98, Jeff Jarrett, he's not worthy of working with me.
Well, now, there was a little, there was some
the
personal.
The Deborah thing.
Yeah, there
yeah,
was
it was the Deborah thing.
Well, let's be honest. He didn't think that. It was solely because of that.
It was a thing of Austin, and maybe it was only as protective as top guys should be, but was protective of, I don't want to necessarily work with every Tom, Dick, and Harry.
True, although, you know, obviously, that one black mark on his career, you know, it's funny we talk about Austin now. He wasn't on this 2002 show because he refused a job to Brock Lesnar on Raw.
This would have been the last one of his active career, and he wasn't there for it.
Look, he may be hiding behind this,
mm-hmm.
but he always like, well, you know, I didn't have a problem jobbing to him, but jobbing him on a Raw with no announcement is stupid.
He's absolutely right.
Oh, he is. He is. But it's interesting. You wonder, would you have jobbed him? Would you have on pay-per-view? Because he should.
That's a very good question.
A well-promoted Austin Lesnar match, just like a well-promoted Rock Lesnar match, Lesnar should go over.
Right.
It's almost like, I'm not calling the guy out, because he said on the DVD he wouldn't have had a problem jobbing to him. But it's interesting. Had they done it properly, because it was stupid. I mean, you cannot not a King of the Ring qualifying. Well, he gets, it was pretty funny. You could see he gets like legitimately irritated that was a decision. I mean, he was like mad.
Yeah. Well, he saw that it was a receipt for some of his questioning of the creative stuff and everything he wanted to do. Well, here's a good place to bring it around at when you look at it that way. As far as Steve Austin and as far as SummerSlam 03 and when we start in Chapter 4 with the next part of this year. At the beginning of that era, Brock Lesnar is still one of the top guys, and Steve Austin is out of the picture. I think for Austin, I think it's all a question of his neck, because mm-hmm. he knew, and he says, now I don't think this is all just revisionism. Part of the reason he left in 02 was there was some strain that he knew he didn't have much time left.
If he knew
he didn't have a whole lot of time left, he would have put over Lesnar clean.
Because
he put The Rock over clean as his final act as a wrestler. He wanted to bring that whole story full cycle.
Yes.
Even though it was awkward because it meant that the heel Rock was going over him for the happy ending, which was kind of weird.
Yeah. So, again, 02, 03, a lot of just logistical nightmares.
But yep.
More on that in a later podcast.
We'll talk about it.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.